But what is Conspirators planning to become then?
A platform for me to just talk about random shit that I want to talk about.
Wow. So you're going to become the Indian Joe Rogan?
Sure.
I love it. I think this is an unfulfilled niche. You know, you just need to go bald again.
Who else has a podcast like that where they just talk about random? Yeah, I think Joe Rogan's is probably. He still has guests on. Mine, this is supposed to be less about guests and more just random shit I want to talk about, but it's weird to talk to yourself. So I'll just find someone else to come talk about it with me.
No, that's fair. You don't want to just be a narrator.
Yeah. All right. How do I normally start this? Okay. I hate starting. Starting is the worst part.
Start with advertisements.
We are advertising this great crypto custody company called Anchorage. If you have custody needs, use Anchorage. Way better than Coinbase. Coinbase is trash. You know what I mean? No, but really, today I'm here with Akash. He is one of my friends from Berkeley together. And, you know, we have a long history together. Together, we've taken the worst computer science class at UC Berkeley, which we still did no work on, and we got carried the entire time. Akash today is working at Anchorage, a company in SF, and you know, I wanted to talk about a little bit of the stuff that's going on in Silicon Valley right now, and I figured I needed someone who's actually there, because I'm not anymore. I moved out 6 months ago, so I wanted to bring Akash on because he's actually there. Although technically you're not, right? Technically you're not there right now.
I'm still there in spirit compared to you. Technically my office is still there, but we're actually getting rid of that.
You guys are scrapping the office completely?
Yeah, the office is gone for some time. We were planning on getting a new office anyways, but okay. We decided, you know, the timing just seemed right to drop it and just work remote until things change.
So is everyone in the company going remote now?
Yeah, everybody's been work from home. So this is where things are going. I think we went 10 years into the future when this whole thing happened.
To be honest, all this talk about remote work, I'm not super convinced on it. As someone who's worked at a pretty remote company for the last 3 years, I'm not sure how well it works out long term.
Yeah, I have mixed opinions about it too. One of the things that I think is very important to in-person work, especially if you're trying to build a company, is, you know, you're trying to find those co-founders, those people that you can work with, those people that you can hire. And if you're doing remote work, it's very hard to cultivate like the same level of relationship and like trust from hundreds of miles away or thousands of miles away.
Yeah, I think this is something that happened at Tendermint. The co-founders, which is Jay and Bucky, they were living in two different cities. Early on, they were both spending a lot more time together, but they started spending less and less time together because they were so far apart. I think that's a problem. I think another issue is, if you're going to go remote, you got to go all in on the decentralization. When I first started at Tendermint, like everyone was remote and just like working from their own place. We had some people in like Russia and Indonesia and all over the place, and everyone was just scattered. That kind of worked well. But then over time, we actually started building hubs in San Francisco, Toronto, and Berlin. I think what ended up happening is when everyone's in your company's in one office, then all communication is happening synchronously and everyone's like kind of there together. When everyone is completely remote, all communication has to go on like Slack or something that's public. When you have these multiple hubs, what happens is the people in Berlin are talking to each other much more synchronously, and not all of that communication gets recorded. And then people in San Francisco don't find out about it. But I think like having multiple hubs is the worst spot to be in. You either want to go full decentralized remote or one office.
I see. When you say multiple hubs, what about companies that have many different offices, but they don't necessarily do remote work? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think that's probably one of the worst ones.
That's the worst one, okay.
Yeah, because intra-hub, you have a lot of great synchronous communication. But then it actually has really bad inter-hub communication. One of the reasons I love spending time at the Berlin office for Tendermint was become much more closer to the other people who go to the office, because there people would go to the office every single day. We'd go out for lunch every day, just chatting, and you know, communication was way more synchronous and better, but not all the stuff that we ended up discussing got recorded on Slack or somewhere for everyone else in the company to see. And so it builds up these bubbles within the company.
What you're describing, I think, is very much saying, you know, remote work is sort of the second class citizen of centralized everybody work in one HQ, because everybody's trying to replace all these benefits that come from working in a centralized place. And that's actually what a lot of products are thinking about doing when it comes to remote work. They're trying to make asynchronous communication feel like it's more synchronous. I definitely see that there's downsides to going the asynchronous route, unless you go all in on it, which in that case, you're actually opting into other benefits. As you said, one good example of this is you can hire lower labor costs if you run a company, if you decide to distribute across the entire globe, because you basically expanded the reach of your hiring. And hiring is definitely one of the hardest things when it comes to startup growth.
Yeah. I think maybe it also might be like about the size of the company. When you're large enough, maybe it's okay to have, as long as individual teams are more centralized in one spot, it's okay if you have like one entire dev team based in Berlin, but another team that's working on a different product or something based in a different city. That works for like larger companies, but like for a startup, like the entire company is like 20 people anyway. At that point, you don't have teams. A small startup at that scale is just one giant team. So I think they should try to be in one spot, especially very early on.
Yeah, I wonder if you can maybe improve. So one thing that's an issue with the current distributed like workforce is like time zones. Like it's very hard to synchronize just in general. I wonder if people will try to concentrate into maybe continentally, or maybe concentrating in time zones might be like a better strategy than doing cross time zone synchronization.
Yeah, no, the time zone thing is also another part that, you know, take into account, because, you know, for Tendermint, we were pretty, you know, SF and Berlin are pretty, it's like, you know, the work days don't overlap that much other than for an hour or two.
Yeah. What I would like to see in this section of industry, the whole concept of remote work, is like, I think what we're missing is quantitative metrics for how big of a difference remote work is versus working in the office. I think we have some obvious ones that we can use. There's a lot more granularity to it than we can actually measure currently.
Yeah, I think data would be really good. I feel every time I bring up like personal qualms with remote, everyone's like, oh, but look at Valve. Look, they're completely remote. And look how amazing they are. Like, okay, great. You have one good example. No, I think we need more data to really judge outcomes here.
Yeah, like we don't know why some people do really well with it, and we don't know why some people might do really bad with it. It could come down to something so qualitative, like, for example, a good manager company. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you pull that piece of data onto the surface and say, hey, this is actually the problem is, and this is what affects your remote work option to as a company.
Do you think that technology will be able to help this? Do you think technology will make it easier? I mean, one thing I'll say is that we tried at Tendermint, there were like multiple times we had these proposals where, all right, let's make a Discord server and everyone will hang out on Discord while they work. And so that way it kind of like can simulate being in an office where you can talk to anyone randomly and stuff. But I don't think any of those proposals ever lasted more than like 2 days.
Yeah. So you've probably seen the whole thing with like Clubhouse and all that.
Are you on Clubhouse? Everyone's talking about
it. I am not on Clubhouse, unfortunately. I think it's people have kind of been going apeshit over it. I believe the way it works is, so it's invite only right now. They just closed some pretty interesting investments. I think people like create rooms, and then people basically sit in those rooms and then go to those rooms and like hang out. It's all virtual. And it's just audio, basically, I think. It's audio and video.
Is this like, I mean, have you used House Party?
I've not used House Party, but it does sound very similar to House Party. But I think the difference here is curation. I think Clubhouse actually might be doing things in a way that you can go and meet strangers in these rooms about specific topics. It's almost like you're going to a club, hence the term Clubhouse. I haven't used it, so I'm making assumptions based on what I've seen. But House Party lets you do this amongst friends that you know.
Well, I mean, with House Party, yeah, it is amongst friends. You can end up in people you don't know, because let's say if you have a mutual friend and like I joined your room and then another friend who also joined your room. I've met a couple of people on House Party like that, but yeah, you do need at least a couple hops away.
Clubhouse,
like anyone on the network, you can end up on a room with them.
Exactly. So the differences are actually very much intuitive in their name. House Party, it's like you're at a house party. Clubhouse, right. It's like you're at some like club and like you're in someone's house or I don't know.
Well, I imagine the clubhouse, I don't think it's supposed to evoke like nightclub style. I assumed it was like a golf clubhouse. Oh, this like, you know, very, like sort of secluded thing where you'll go to the clubhouse and you'll meet other people who also are members of that country club. So I imagine like the sort of the exclusivity part is like a big part of it, right?
Yeah, I would say so. There's a lot of high profile people that have gotten access to the network. The thing I find interesting about invite only, is if you get the high profile people in, like, and they just go into their network, they're probably going to have a good time because they have a really good network and they're just going to bring it to the platform. And then all of a sudden, all their friends are on the platform. So then the next people that come next are going to be like, holy crap, like this is amazing. There's all these people that I never had access to before. And then it just goes down the tree from there. I find it to be a very like interesting like tactic to grow like an app.
I mean, obviously it's very much used by what a lot of VCs and stuff, right? That's one of the main initial target markets, I guess. Those are the exclusive people who are on there.
I think that was intentional. I'm going to argue that may have been intentional because they are like hubs of people. That is a lot of the job of VC to know like what people are doing. They tend to have better networks than like, an individual contributor at a company might. And the next level down is really then like maybe C-level people, founders. Like you have to start with the people who have free time and also have a great network. And VCs
so are definitely, would you like, be willing to say within the Silicon Valley class structure, VCs are like the top tier elites?
That's a really good question.
Okay, maybe the top tier elites are legendary level founders. The very next one under that would be like the VCs. Are they the most like sort of connected and hip?
So I guess it depends what you mean by VC, right? Like VC is like this very broad encompassing term. But what kind of VC are you? Are you like the associate VC? Are you like the partner at A16Z where everyone becomes a partner? Or are you like the greatest investor in the Valley and founded many companies that changed the trend over time? Mm-hmm. The way I want to think about this hierarchy is I almost want to model it in a similar way to like churches or like how the clergy used to be like at the top. And like, because I feel like that's how academia is. I think academia fits the mold of being very mirrored to like the church. Where like or the
where it's like you have,
I it has roots in religion, right? A lot of these institutions were religious and they had this power hierarchy that was very mirrored in that sense. Like getting your doctorate degree, definitely a pretentious thing to say in a way. Or saying that I'm like a professor versus an associate professor or a professor emeritus. Like you just look at all the different possibilities of what you can be in the academia hierarchy, I think it's very much modeled out in a church-like way.
So you were saying about how is the Silicon Valley structure like sort of church-like as well?
I think they're the storytellers who definitely sit at the top. So probably maybe like the legends of the Valley, the biggest VC, Andreessen Horowitz, the leaders of Sequoia Capital, the people who really make a big dent when it comes to a trend, like funding and all that, or who compose of many ex-entrepreneurs. I would say those people are the clergy, the equivalent of
the Pope.
Who's the Pope? That's a really good question. I don't know who's leading charge these days. It tends to be a subjective thing, depending on what section you work in. I don't have a good answer for who's the Pope.
I guess Balaji is someone who's been very up in front recently. You worked pretty closely with him in the past. You interned at 21. What are your total thoughts on like his entire development over the last couple months?
I was focused on coronavirus. I got to give he found out, or I wouldn't say he necessarily found out before everyone else, but he was the one who was sort of talking about it before everyone else was in the Valley.
Yeah.
He was the one signaling that this is going to be a problem. Most people threw it off, like a lot of journalism threw it off. And the nature of American culture and all that sort of dismissed it as it's another virus. Like I haven't had like nobody who has lived today probably has really experienced like a real pandemic. So it's okay. Take it with a grain of salt was the attitude. What was interesting to see is, you know, outside thinking be the forefront of what's happening like today. All of a sudden, he was 100% correct about like what's happening.
Yeah. I bring it up because one of the topics I wanted to talk about, which we were wrapping on earlier, was this notion that Silicon Valley is going to go to war with Washington. What I mean by that is the Silicon Valley elite, or let's call it the clubhouse elites, because that's what it
is. The clubhouse elites, yeah.
Yeah, the clubhouse elites. They're going to war with the traditional elites, the Washington elites. Let me give a summary of my thoughts, what I've been thinking about, and then you tell me if what you think of, if that even makes sense. What I've been thinking is this growing sense in Silicon Valley that the current ruling class is completely incompetent. They're the ones who created all the value in the last two decades. They think that the competence of running companies translates well to running the country. So there was a Twitter poll that Naval, he's another important figure in all this, I think. But he had who do you want to run the country? And had this poll, and entrepreneurs was the one that won by some crazy margin, 80% or something. I don't remember the exact number. That this whole COVID stuff has exacerbated this massively, where this biology stuff you were talking about, where I noticed this myself, I was in New York at the time, and I just felt this massive difference in the reactions back in February between SF and New York. In New York, no one cared. You couldn't even tell anything was different. While in SF, people were talking about it. There was just this sense that they caught this thing earlier than the people who are supposed to be working on it, which is the government, did. And when they talked about it, they were mocked about it. And that's that journal article you were talking about where they were making fun of A16Z, no handshakes. And it's oh, you idiots, the government said it's fine. Who do you think you are? Yeah, whatever. I think that culminated in that whole Mark Andreessen's it's time to build thing, which I felt this is a declaration of war. It's basically him saying all right, the current government or the current ruling class is super incompetent, and it's time for Silicon Valley to start taking the reins.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts on this. I definitely agree with what you have to say about Mark Andreessen's article being a declaration of war. In a sense, what he was doing with that article was saying that it's time to take matters into our own hands, right? That was the essence of it. It wasn't we can't just sit around. It was sort of a declaration saying we can't just sit around and just let the problem just exacerbate. Yeah.
But into whose hands? You say yeah. Into our hands, but who is the our here?
Who is us? Yeah. I'm going to have to agree with you that it was Silicon Valley. Okay. Let me think about this for a second. So one thing you said earlier was that you think that it's becoming mainstream consensus that there is this elite in Washington, and they are the incompetent ones in the reality of the situation, right? I'd like to hear more about whether or not you think that's a mainstream view, because I still think people don't really point Washington as much on average, but maybe Silicon Valley might. The other thing is, in the context of Mark Andreessen's post, who is he addressing? He's definitely addressing the people who are willing to build. I think in the majority of cases, it's been Silicon Valley. It's been in other places too, maybe. But I think it's disproportionately going to focus on the locale.
So your first question of, do you think it's a mainstream view that the Washington elite is this? To be honest, it's hard for me to say, because obviously I have my biases, and obviously I am very much cut from the cloth of the Silicon Valley, right? I hesitate to what I think of what the mainstream view is, because I'm not sure if I know. But I would say that I think the whole drain the swamp, the entire Trump election was a reactionary thing to the Washington elites. It's more from a populist bent than a technocratic bent, which is sort of where the Silicon Valley side is coming.
I think Silicon Valley likes the technocratic side of things. They're definitely not on the same page when it comes to grassroots populism, destroying the establishment. I think they have to be able to fight the establishment on their own terms. That's the perspective that of I think many Silicon Valley people.
So one of the things I brought up in that thread was there's this like tweet I saw. There's a great blog called The Scholar's Stage. It's a blog by this guy. He lives in Taiwan, but he writes a lot of really good stuff about like Chinese culture and stuff. So definitely recommend it to anyone who's listening. Check it out. In one of his posts called "The Problem Isn't the Merit, It's the Ocracy." So just talking about like, you know, meritocracy. But he linked to this tweet from this guy named Liam Bright. And I just love this tweet. I'll read it out loud. "Liberal technocrats give us literally no reason at all to think that their interests are aligned with the great majority of the people. Yet when they are attacked as a governing class, they stress their credentials and competency. But it'd be much worse if they were doing bad stuff efficiently." I don't know if this is true or not. Like, this is maybe something that we need to examine. But if the current Washington elite is not aligned with the people, whatever that means, Silicon Valley's sort of response is that, oh, we're more competent. But that's not actually evidence that they're more aligned with the people. And so do you think that the Clubhouse elites are more aligned with the people than the current Washington elites?
Ooh. That's a great question. The Clubhouse elites, or whatever we're calling the Silicon Valley.
I like that terminology. I think it's great because it like fits with current events.
Sure. I think that elite, you know, has been trained with a very different mindset than the elite of Washington. I think the reason why Wall's poll, you know, received so much optimism in that case about entrepreneurs, has a lot to do with, you know, the ethos of entrepreneurs and you know, what they've done in their lives. Because I think when you look at hiring, a lot of people will try to look at skills. They'll try to get data points off people that may result in them doing a good job. And in some ways, like the voting process, you could maybe look at the same way. People are getting data points from many different places and trying to see if they do a good job. But in most cases, history is probably most telling of how well someone will do their job. Like in terms of a predictor, it tends to be the best. So if you just look at the previous outcomes of many of these entrepreneurs, their job has really been like a few things. They report at a high level. This is not trying to diminish anyone's work in Silicon Valley. At a high level, right, they are, you know, serving the customer and they are responding to the investor. There's the two biggest things that they have to do. In some sense, in the case of government, someone in government is supposed to be serving the public in a way. And the public is both the investor and the customer. I think that in a way, there's almost like no better candidate for running countries than, say, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, at least in that regard. They might not be the best politicians, right? They might not be the best person to come up with rhetoric and convince people. But they certainly will be good operators. I think there's no question about that. And I think what people want in government is people who actually just operate. Because a lot of government, I think people are starting to realize, is just a lot of talk, right? I think the reason why people voted in a candidate like Trump, especially on the populist side, I think had a lot to do with the fact they weren't seeing many results from previous years of presidency. Not much has changed in regards to the system and overall like how it works. Much of the stuff has stayed the same. In terms of technological development, if you look at America as a whole, most of it has kind of stagnated. Like Peter Thiel has that like famous thesis about how Silicon Valley is one of the few places that continues to make progress.
We need to come back and talk about Peter Thiel at some point as well. But yeah, keep going.
Yeah. I do think that the entrepreneur ethos is a huge thing.
So is it an incentives problem? So the problem is, yes, I agree that entrepreneurs are doing the work. I think the reason they, you know, listen to customers is because at the end of the day, they're trying to bring back a return to their investors. And the reason they're doing that is because at the end of the day, they're trying to bring back a personal return to themselves. When you go into politics, that sort of personal wealth generation isn't really an incentive. Do you think that is going to be a problem?
Yeah. So I think we have to look into why politicians sort of become politicians. It's like, why Silicon Valley people never really decided to become politicians, and people of the same skill caliber never became politicians. If you look at a politician at a high level, we can assume that there's a few reasons why they're in office. I think one is like,
how many opportunities. Past, like, U.S. presidents were businessmen?
I don't think there were many. Trump is definitely a very different president than many of the past presidents.
So the one I can only think of off the top of my head is Herbert Hoover. But yeah. I also read something about him pretty recently.
Yeah.
And also, he's not really exactly well renowned for his economic policies. Continue with what you were saying.
Yeah. So I think another way of looking at the whole analogy is Ronald Reagan was an actor. He was someone who had success in industry in a way. You could say he had other opportunities at hand. One reason why people don't become, you know, entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley is because opportunity cost, right? You could be doing so much more with your life if you decide to go into industry, if you decide to become part of the mold of an entrepreneur. If you go that route, you get to make decisions that actually result in things being done. Whereas in politics, so much more time, I think, is spent on decision-making rather than doing, that the whole principle of how the system works is just very different. And also, the culture is very different. In Silicon Valley, in the case of Uber, we've laid off a quarter of the workforce, for example. If you look at governments, I mean, have you heard about any layoffs that have happened lately in government when they have obviously like a large surplus of employees by comparison?
Part of the problem here is that when you're running a company, decision-making is easier because at the end of the day, it's about your bottom line, right? It's about the profit, and that's what you're trying to maximize, right? Yeah. Everything else is an input into that, you know, primary measure. While in governance, like or in civic governance, the measure is, I think, decision-making is much harder because you're not trying to maximize over any one measure. It's within your constituency. You have all these different viewpoints and conflicting desires that are hard to balance.
Yeah, I think it's both a blessing and a curse in a way. In part, this is possibly what leads to more interesting moral outcomes in governance. But I think in terms of the progress and velocity of outcomes in governance, it definitely gets slowed down when you take into account these many inputs. Maybe an entrepreneur from Silicon Valley is kind of a refreshing thing to have in government because you have this person who is actually a little more used to laser focus when it comes to decision making. Whereas a lot of these other people, the peak of their career was this political job. That's the case for many people in office who run political positions like this. This is their moment and this is what they train into. Whereas like Silicon Valley, the people have training from other sessions, right? They've done decision making in other situations. And I think this is why people, in some cases, when VCs see someone like a Navy SEAL or something, they know that this guy has incredible decision-making skills already. Mm-hmm. They can generally make assumptions based on their past that, hey, they're going to be great at this one thing. The same thing, I think, people want to apply to politics in a way. It's like, for once, it's very refreshing to see that, hey, this person in the past, they know how to make decisions when it comes to a certain context. There's a good chance it will translate over to this context in this way.
In Naval's tweet with that poll, who do you want to run your country? And I kind of a little bit snarkily replied that let the entrepreneurs fix SF first and then we'll talk. Okay, so if you think that Silicon Valley mindset can be translated to civic governance, how do we explain the current state of San Francisco as a city? I got so fed up with it that I left 6 months ago. What's wrong with SF city governance, and why have all these smart people in SF not solved this yet?
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of layers to this one problem. That's probably the reason why it hasn't been solved. I'll try to point at some of the layers that I've seemingly found while living there. Mm-hmm. One thing is that Silicon Valley previously didn't have much interest in dealing with politics, and it never really has. It was never really its forte. The people there were kind of, you know, government will figure itself out. It's not really
government. Government was an obstacle. Whatever extent Silicon Valley did deal with government, it was with lobbying to reduce regulation, because government was an obstacle, nothing else.
Yeah, in the context of company building out, it was definitely considered an obstacle, if anything. Or because of the government actually not being able to keep up with every single development on the internet. I think there was some arbitrage that happened here. And this is what, you know, people are saying crypto might be able to do. Like, there's this regulatory arbitrage that potentially leads to innovation. But people are quickly realizing that when it comes to money, the government's a lot more on top of things. So it's like not quite the same.
There's the Ben Hunt, the what's his blog's name again? Hold on 1 second. It's going to annoy me if I don't find it. Epsilon Theory.
Epsilon Theory.
Yeah. So in Epsilon Theory, one of my favorite articles of his is talking about why money is the government's baby and they're never going to let anyone touch that thing. He brings up this, uses Bible quote, where Jesus is like, leave unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. So it was this like thing about where some of Jesus's disciples are coming to him and saying, oh, should we pay our taxes, right? What right does the Roman government at that time have to charge taxes? Jesus knew that's one thing we can't touch. And so he's like, look at the coin. Whose face is on there? It's like Caesar's. So he's like, okay, so if it's Caesar's, let him collect Caesar's stuff and leave unto Caesar's that which is Caesar's and everything else unto God or something like that. So yeah, the government will not want you to fuck with money.
Yeah, I'm very much in agreement with that. I think that's why even the biggest companies, when it comes to these crypto projects, have had to back down quite a bit in terms of their scope. Like Libra was supposed to be this game changer for the crypto industry, and now there's been a lot of pushback from many different parties on what its scope is. I don't know the details of it, but the government really doesn't want people to take over its sovereignty when it comes to this thing.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what were you saying before this? So you were talking about the layers. We were talking about
this, like, is the ball thing. Yeah, the SF. We're talking about why SF is kind of shitty.
So you were talking about the layers of what you think.
Layered why, problem.
Yeah.
So I think in the context of SF, there's a few layers to it. One is that there is very low, I think, political participation in the local community, especially for the people that represent SF. There's just very low participation. So the people that go out and participate tend to be the people that you could maybe say don't have anything else to care about that's as important as this voting thing. So they're the ones that go and vote. So the people who really think voting matters, they'll go and vote. The thing is, most of the tech workers, they don't think the voting really matters. They don't see it as a means to an end. Whereas a lot of the old establishment, SF, they continue to vote because many of them have property, many of them have neighborhoods that they are actually quite integrated with. I would say SF's culture is sort of a transient one when it comes to the younger people or the workforce. You can just see this by going in downtown SF. You can just see there's nobody that hangs out there on weekdays. It's very similar to how people treat Wall Street. So if you go to West SF, or if you go maybe towards the Civic Center and below, like Mission and like Case Valley, if you go there, you'll see a bunch of locals just hanging out. And it's actually not very touristy. So then that just begs the question, why is there such limited civic participation in these elections? I don't have a completely straight answer other than it's cultural. It's also just like the neighborhood legacies that some of these neighborhoods sort of held on to.
Do you think that if we could get enough of the techies to vote, that would solve the problem?
Yeah, you know, I think if tech employers made it, like let's say you could just vote during work hours, and it was sort of a requirement or something. I'm sure that would actually bring a lot more turnout than people voluntarily. Like, they might get the mail in their mailbox and it says, oh, you got to mail this to vote. Nobody wants to go to the mailbox and like send mail. I don't remember the last time I sent this mail because it takes time. I think these people in SF, they're busy people. They want to spend their time on other things. So the voting UX, I think, is a big thing. I think that actually does help with participation. The less friction there is in voting, the more likely you are to probably go vote. I think that's part of it. But then there's also, how much does my vote actually impact, like, what's happening in SF? And if you just look at If you've ever done the SF local elections, or if you've ever voted on the propositions, mm-hmm. my roommate Anthony, he actually ended up going through everything and reading every individual thing that you could vote on. And it took him maybe an hour to go through everything, like research. And we did this for fun, but I can't imagine anybody taking the time out of the day to go and read about every little thing, every candidate.
Yeah. One of my friends, she did that too. She read every single proposition and had these notes on research. I'm like, wow, you're the only person I've ever seen do this.
Yeah, exactly. So there is such a minority of people that are going to go and do that. There will be no, very little informed votes, if anything. And on top of that, because there's weak voter participation, that's not going to lead to any better outcomes. So I think SF needs to make this place a bit more livable if people are going to care more about voting.
One of the things that solves this problem is political parties, right? Most people, like you say, don't have the time to evaluate every single proposition. So normally what they'll just do is take the high-level messages of a political party and say, okay, I align with what these guys are saying, and I'll just go with whichever propositions they tell me to vote on, and I'll just vote however they do. So do you think that a potential solution to this problem is build a techie political party in San Francisco that tells all the technical people how to vote? And so people know, okay, I trust these guys. Let me just go vote with like whatever they're saying.
Yeah, I think this is an untapped opportunity in a way. The tech companies have a lot of influence in San Francisco. There's no question about it. If there's one thing that's keeping the economy running in SF right now, and if there's one thing that maybe led to the federal stimulus of San Francisco itself, from mm-hmm. Mr. President himself, it was probably the tech companies of San Francisco that are responsible for mm-hmm. such a thing. So, you know, their influence is big. For somebody to
be better.
Yeah, given this current situation, given this current situation, I think there will be a lot of people moving out of SF. Rent reasons, small businesses.
Wait, that doesn't sound like any better. That sounds like a failure, not a improvement.
I think failure short-term could lead to long-term potentially better outcomes. So the way I think about it is sometimes when there are cases where companies, they'll reach a point where they're burning a lot of money and they're not making enough to sustain. All of a sudden, the business just doesn't look like it's going to scale. So it's like, oh, crap, we need to do something about this. And we don't think we can grow this much within the next year. So it's time to lay people off because we can't do anything about it. SF is having this similar thing going on in its mind. In a way, the short-term losses, whether it's small businesses having to shut down, businesses having to rethink who they're hiring, just like stopping local development, I think in the case of SF, if this trickles up to local government, like they have to lay off people in local government, all of a sudden they have to start rethinking, okay, what do we do as a government? Then I could see this thing turning out well. There still is a lot of mismanagement happening in SF. There's no question about it. Sure, they handled the coronavirus in a way they handled the coronavirus, but relative to their other problems, I actually think the coronavirus problem is probably simpler in the sense that there's only one thing they can do until there's a cure. and it's like you can basically shut down all activity and just wait for science to solve the problem. That's one thing you can do. And because they have all the tech companies, they have some tax revenue continuing to come in as a result. But if the tech companies leave, then okay, that's a different story. They're going to be running a budget deficit. And then all of a sudden, SF is going to be in the red. And there's going to be some serious problems. And I think SF realized this when the coronavirus came. They realized that if it conquers SF, if it turns SF into this really, really terrible place, and I'm not saying SF is a great place by any means, their money, their ability to spend on anything, which is what a lot of decisions of government is about. It's about where to allocate money, goes away. A lot of that leverage goes away. So they're very dependent on tech companies. There's no coordination as to tech companies trying to fight or cooperate with the government. There's only been this quiet adversarial environment created between tech companies. There hasn't been too much dialogue as to like, okay, we're collaborating on this or we're actually fighting against this. It's just been like, Twitter and Square were allowing people to work remote. And that was it. That's all you heard about that. Yeah. But there could have been a lot of things in the background between them and the government saying, oh, please don't do this. Like, we can try to work with you to make it so that you stay in SF. Stripe ended up leaving too. So there was a lot of companies that wanted to leave SF actually prior to this whole thing happening.
Do you think there's credence to the other side of the argument of the divide? So I had Eric Meltzer on this podcast a while ago. He brought up this idea that San Francisco is still this city that's whose population is slightly higher than Milwaukee, but with an economy the size of New York. SF traditionally has not been a very big city. It's always been this small city. In California, Los Angeles was the main city. Even San Jose in the Bay Area is bigger than San Francisco. Then suddenly it had all this tech stuff. This divide is between these people who want SF to remain this small, quaint town that it was versus the people who want to turn it into this giant metropolis on the scale of New York. Is there credence to the people who want to remain it, to keep it small? Is that a reasonable position to have, or is that just sort of a lost cause at this point?
Yeah, I think it depends. It's definitely a two-sided battle, right? It depends which side you're on. If you're on the side of the NIMBYs, then you're going to say, I don't want any more of this happening in my city. If you're on the side of technology and the companies, and you're like, okay, build more housing, public transit, et cetera, spend more on things that matter. There's only one problem that I think maybe both people possibly agree on, and maybe that's the homeless. Like homelessness is a problem. They just don't know how to solve it. So there is some acknowledgement that, hey, we agree that the problems exist. We just can't come to agreement on how to deal with it the right way. So then it's like, let's just spend as much money until something happens. That's been the experiment in SF so far. Just spend money on shelters, spend money on making SF this hub for homelessness in a way. There is something to be said about the people that own property in SF and don't want progress in their backyard. I think the argument sucks. I think it's hard to favor that side because so much economic development has happened in SF that is pretty much antithetical to what they stand for. Mm-hmm. I think money talks, right? But in the case of SF, money hasn't really talked. So why is that? I don't have the best explanations as to why it hasn't talked. I think there will soon be some changes that happen after this whole pandemic is over.
So one of the problems is the homelessness. What else do you think are major structural problems in San Francisco right now? One of them, I would say, is transportation. I think public transportation in SF is just atrocious. After having lived in New York now for 3 or 4 months, I'm like, it's amazing that I can get literally anywhere in the city using public transportation. And SF, is, I don't know, just not the case. To be honest, I've never actually used the Muni, so maybe that's my fault. I don't even know how the Muni works. Where do I even get onto the Muni? So yeah, that might be partially my fault. One of the stories I really thought was really funny was about how one of my friends, his family lives in South Bay, and every couple of years his proposal is like, oh, should we extend the BART into South Bay? The people who live in South Bay, their property values are really high because transportation to South Bay sucks. Or the traffic is so high to South Bay. That's where a lot of the large companies like Google and Facebook and yada yada are. And the problem is if transportation into South Bay becomes easier, then their property values might go down. That ends up getting blocked. And so I always thought that was a weird case of NIMBYism also causing problems. Yeah, what are some of the other problems you see?
Yeah, homelessness, public transport, I think allocating funds. I forget what the numbers are, but in terms of how much money SF makes from the locale, the companies, the people, the properties, you just have to think about how much money just gets aggregated through that. And then you have to think about, well, wait a second, why is SF like, why does SF feel like a third world country in some neighborhoods? It's very strange. So I think allocation of money is one thing. I think city planning is another thing. So if you just look at a lot of the design of the streets and stuff, the city design hasn't been planned for the scale that the technocrats are looking for. And at the same time, the NIMBYs don't want to change the ground level like appearance of what the city looks like, or they don't want a skyscraper sitting in front of their view. There's a lot of weird decisions that have to be made around city planning that are pretty political. I think something that happened in New York is New York got built up in the early 19th century. Most of Manhattan got really built up in the 19th century. So this was an acceptable, there was actually pushback from many people about building up Manhattan. there were advocates that got famous for pushing back against the governor at the time. But in today's age, I don't know if you could do the same thing, same scale. I think one part of it is because there's more people, there's more investment involved in trying to build things when there's more structure already in place. The hardest thing is iterating on existing land that has already been developed. So city planning is one of them, both in the context of how do you politically satisfy every single side? What do you do with historical buildings? Should we build up? Should we do landfill? Should we care about earthquake proneness? There's all these weird questions that have to be answered.
Is earthquake proneness a big part of it as well? This is just something I always assume, but I never actually bothered to check. Like, is it? It's probably more expensive to build up in SF than it is in New York, right? Just because of earthquake precautions?
Yeah, it is. Building up in SF, it becomes more expensive because you can only build so high unless you build buildings a certain way in earthquake-prone zones. There's also the constraint of much of SoMa in SF is actually landfill. It's not actually like land mass that was there before. So, you know, there's a major liquefaction zone in like the middle of downtown SF, which is unfortunate. But, you know, it's a city planning decision for some reason was made, probably made in favor of economic costs and other things.
It seems that people are starting to get more interested in politics. Do you think we're going to have someone run for mayor, or do you think we're going to have a future mayor of San Francisco be someone from this clubhouse elite soon?
It depends if everyone leaves. Yeah, if everyone leaves, then I think SF will have to kind of figure out stuff on its own.
If the clubhouse elite want to start running the country, they need to at least show San Francisco as an MVP. And if they fail to do that, I think it should be very unlikely for them to take charge of a country.
Yeah, that's fair. I think the one thing with transformation is that when is the last time you've heard of politicians go through the massive transformation of whether it's a city and its policies, or you don't really hear situations where people have to go in and fix everything. So that's hard to say that it's the standard for
future. I mean,
like,
isn't that kind of
future,
what like, Michael Bloomberg got famous for doing in New York? I wasn't living in New York at the time.
Yeah.
But when he started running for president, I was in New York and I was just asking around people who have been living in New York for a while. And they're like, yeah, dude, Michael Bloomberg came in, he fixed New York. I mean, my point is, it seems that the mayors can have a lot of impact.
Yeah. That's a good point. Michael Bloomberg is an interesting example because he's an entrepreneur. And all of a sudden you see you have good anecdotal examples of Michael Bloomberg doing some great things. I should probably read more up on that, but I don't have a great answer for how the entrepreneurs are going to prove the end results.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to have anyone run for president anytime soon?
Would you say Andrew Yang doesn't count?
I would say Andrew Yang is almost like he was a reactionary to something that hasn't happened yet. I would say that Andrew Yang, he represented the people. I think Andrew Yang was such a great candidate where I think he had the technocratic skills, but I also felt that he understood and was more aligned with the people than. So yeah, I mean, I think he was sort of a lost opportunity almost. The thing is, he's not part of the clubhouse elite. You know what I mean?
He's not at all.
He somehow managed to get a lot of
he might be popularity. Now.
Yeah, maybe he is now. Yeah, he somehow managed to get a lot of popularity with the Silicon Valley elite, but I don't think he's not cut from that cloth. I had this tweet a little while ago where I was thinking of this comparison between Bernie Sanders and William Jennings Bryan, where William Jennings Bryan was fighting the second industrial revolution and the changes it was having to America by, like, he wanted to sort of revert to an America 1.0, this very agrarian society. He inevitably failed, right? I think Bernie Sanders is trying to fight this information age technological revolution with very America 2.0 industrial age thing. I feel this whole socialist system was a very industrial age reactionary movement. I don't think that socialism is a proper tool in the current information age. I feel that Andrew Yang understood America 3.0 and the information age. I think that this sort of divide between the Clubhouse elites and him is going to be, I think, one of the main political divisions in the 21st century, not capitalists versus socialists anymore.
That's an interesting one. So, Andrew Yang
is socialist? I'm like, I don't know. Not really. I feel trying to place Andrew Yang on this how socialist spectrum he is. I feel that's like missing the point. He's operating on some sort of different axis here.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. I think Andrew Yang's mindset compared to Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is still old establishment. You can kind of just tell from the way the guy looks, right? Like, I mean, he's much older than Andrew Yang.
He's the old school reactionary outsider.
Like, exactly.
He's the old school outsider. Andrew Yang is the new outsider.
Speaking of old versus new, you ever sometimes look at Congress and wonder, why are all these guys so old?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always wondered. It seems to be a weird thing that there's continued election of the old establishment. It's almost like a conservative viewpoint that everyone shares.
Okay, so, you know, to give some justification, right, to steelman it would be that you can consider the act of governing is this sort of repeated game. By having congressmen who've been there, like if you had term limits of 2 years, for example, or whatever, one single term limits, then I feel that compromise would not be something that happens as much. But when you have these career politicians, you know that you're going to be in Congress with the guy next to you for the next 40 years. Sometimes you have to compromise with them.
That's a good point. I think there's also benefits to that, right? You're less likely to play zero-sum games as a result in Congress.
Exactly.
If the people are around for longer periods of time. Because mm-hmm. You never know one day when you come up with that bill and all of a sudden like the senator is the last guy to make the call on whether or not that bill gets pushed through.
Yeah. I think is one explanation of it, but yeah. So do you think Andrew Yang is representative of the Silicon Valley elite or no?
I think he aligned with some of their views in terms of using the presidential position as this point of leverage in such a way that it helps the information age, right? Andrew Yang was the person that had a connection in some way to Silicon Valley, right? To have that in presidential office is kind of a big deal. It definitely changes the perception of government in a sense. Like all of a sudden, you know, Silicon Valley might be more appealed to cooperate with government, to consider like, okay, this can maybe be used as a tool to our own ends and better everything as a whole. That's what Andrew Yang really was.
Yeah, I think if Silicon Valley wants to enter national politics, they need politicians who aren't like, let's put AI and drones everywhere. And I think Andrew Yang sort of understood that. But at the same time, I felt he wasn't very relatable. I think he was very good online, but when it came to debates and stuff on stage, he just didn't click for me. Even me, who highly supported him, I was like, ah, this guy. Ah. If I didn't know about other stuff about him, I would have been kind of next.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of an issue with politics, right? A lot of it is just like, how do you come off as this person that is likable? Mm-hmm. This is not something that Silicon Valley has always been about. Silicon Valley has more been about, all right, if you're the guy who can get the job done, then this is great. And if you're an asshole, the ends will justify the means in this case. In many cases, that will be justified. Like Andrew Yang was one of those candidates who's very different than the rest of candidates, right? He didn't fit the mold of like, I'm a career politician and like, I've served in government my whole life type thing, like many of the other people have. These other people have a, you know, full history of a career in government positions, military. Andrew Yang was one of those people who was like, I'm this guy who is somewhat reminiscent of that the old American dream that people tend to think about. I think he's a first, is he first generation immigrant? I don't remember. I think he's first generation.
Well, he can't be because he can't run for president if he was a first generation immigrant.
Sorry.
but he was, I think he's a second generation
immigrant. So, I mean, the whole situation with Andrew Yang is kind of unique because you have his Asian American president. He's not part of the old establishment. Never really was part of the government in like any way. He's this outsider who's kind of there to help shake things up.
What do you think that the long-term impact of it are? Like, do you think he ended up actually shaking anything up?
Yeah, I think his impact has been there is possibility for a candidate like him to eventually be to have a place. I don't think it was like his position was more appealing than the Libertarian Party has ever been, right? So that's an accomplishment in itself, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing is, he made it further than a lot of well-established career politicians in the context of the election. He got far enough, and then he ended up folding. If people actually had to choose, they might not choose Biden over Andrew Yang. If that was the two final options presented in front of them, because I think this decision-making tends to be a relative decision-making. I think more people would actually choose Andrew Yang if they were the last two remaining.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, we'll see. I mean, actually, we won't see. I don't know how we would see, but...
yeah. The reason why I say that is because I think Andrew Yang actually feels a little more Obama than Joe Biden does. And people actually liked sort of the ethos of Obama in a way. Like he was young. He had charisma.
Don't you think Pete Buttigieg sort of had more, if I had to say one of the candidates was most Obama-like, it was Buttigieg. And I think Buttigieg and Biden were sort of the prime, like two. The race was primarily between Buttigieg, Biden, and Sanders.
Yeah, I think Buttigieg actually built quite a following, if I understand correctly.
Also, especially within Silicon Valley, he actually got quite a bit of following there as well.
Yeah, I haven't kept up too much with the details, but I will say that Andrew Yang was this candidate who showed that there could be room for the technocratic group in the future, mm-hmm. just based on the fact that he made it that far.
Yeah. So, okay, to zoom back out again, I guess, would be, what do you think is going to change going forward? So I guess we both sort of agreed that something is going to change with Silicon Valley's approach to the rest of the country. What do you think it is that's going to change?
Yeah, I think there's a time when I think Silicon Valley, back in more of the 2000s, where they weren't very involved with legislation. With the introduction of companies like Uber and Amazon and their growth, like all of a sudden the can kind of got forced into Washington. I expect that to scale more. I think Silicon Valley has the power, has the resources, has the connections to go and push even harder on Washington.
Like I mentioned earlier, I think the difference is that earlier its interactions with Washington were trying to reduce regulation. There's a way of wanting to have less to do with government. But I think what's going to change here is Silicon Valley is now start to want more to do with government. They're going to say like, oh, let us be more involved with the operations of the government. And as usual, I think Peter Thiel is a little bit ahead of the game. And you can see that already happened. Like Palantir is a great example of a company who's already taken that on years ago. But I think more companies are going to sort of, Silicon Valley companies are going to want to be more involved with government operations.
Yeah. In the context of technology, before Palantir was like Northrop Grumman, the leader. I still think they are the leader in physical defense technology when it comes to pushing that. Palantir is like software consultancy for government contracts, if anything. There's also Anduril, which I think they're a defense company. I don't think they're based out of Silicon Valley, but they definitely took a lot of funding from Silicon Valley. The guy who founded it, I think he's a controversial figure in Silicon Valley, if I'm not mistaken. But you know, I would say also maybe a bit controversial relative to people's opinions.
What do you think about Facebook and just overall the general interactions that Facebook has had with government in the last 2 years? And yeah, just thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a telltale sign that the involvement of the Valley has to be different right? Because Zuckerberg was summoned to Congress. And then I think Libra, like David Marcus, was also technically summoned to Congress to discuss Libra. All of a sudden, this didn't happen the same way for Uber or Airbnb, I'm pretty sure. So it's just very interesting to see that for these things that haven't even launched yet, for Libra at least, for Facebook, I think that was more for reparations and like, oh, like what have you done type thing? Like, how do we prevent you from doing this in the future? A bit of a political game in a way. That one was a lot more political than like Libra's hearing. Mm-hmm. I think Facebook's example was telling of what the Silicon Valley had to prepare for.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Facebook just happens to be the scapegoat at the time because they all of a sudden had the whole Cambridge Analytica thing, and then a lot of people's data got involved in this, and Congress needed some kind of scapegoat to attack in this case. In the grand scheme of things, I don't know if it was about Facebook. I don't know if there is this greater goals to the U.S. government and Congress as a whole. Maybe they want to have more control over the valley, so they want to get Facebook mm-hmm. in there to start passing bills that center more around that. I think it's foretelling of what Silicon Valley has to be prepared for.
I mentioned Peter Thiel being ahead of the game. I was going to hold an event call back 2 months ago called Governance WTF, a continuation of my WTF series, but got postponed because of coronavirus and stuff. But Phil Dian was going to give a talk there. And the title of his talk was Coin Voting, Neo-Feudalism, and Libra, the Peter Thiel Plot to Take Over the World. So how much do you think Peter Thiel is actually behind a lot of the Libra stuff, and just how involved is he in Facebook's political ambitions? And it sounds very conspiracy theorist. Keep in mind, there's literally a book on Peter Thiel called Conspiracy and how he had this giant plot to take down Gawker. So, you know, thought that out of the question.
You know, I haven't had much thought about Peter Thiel and taking over the whole thing here. I would need more context as to what the conspiracy theory is.
I spent a lot of time reading into like, Peter Thiel's worldview and stuff. And so
yeah, and
just how much of Libra's design is meant to do that. But maybe we can save this for another talk another time.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to do a follow-up, I can read it and then we can talk about it.
Yeah. Cool. Anything else you want to talk about?
Nothing specific for this session. So this actually gives us some good ideas as to what to talk about next. I just want to spend some time thinking about it more before we dive into it.
Sure.
So maybe let's do this. I think whatever you have here, if there's anything good, just take it and use it. And then let's like do another session where it's more nuanced. We have what nuances we want to poke in on.
Yeah.
And then can have more discussion about it.
Sweet. All right. Well, with that, we'll leave it at that then. And thank you guys for listening.